Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Kripko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have the Gulf crisis spilling over into the Horn of Africa. Hiding underneath the mainstream media headlines is a simmering story about how the Gulf crisis is inadvertently reigniting tensions between Eritrea and Djibouti. Both of these Red Sea states chose to side with Saudi Arabia and the UAE against Qatar, which prompted Doha to immediately withdraw its peacekeepers from their disputed border. Qatar originally deployed a few hundred troops to the hotspot following brief but intense clashes in 2008 over an island and a small strip of territory, and while this did successfully keep the peace between both of them in the years since, the conflict has come back to the surface almost immediately after the soldiers' sudden withdrawal earlier this month. For some background into what's going on, Eritrea has had terrible relations with all of its neighbors since becoming independent of Ethiopia in 1993, and it even has territorial claims against a few of them as well, including Djibouti. Up until Asmara sided with the Saudis in the war on Yemen a few years ago, as confirmed by a late 2015 UN investigation, it was totally isolated because it had been under UNSC sanctions due to its support of Al-Qaeda affiliate Al-Shabaab in Somalia. As for Djibouti, it functions as the irreplaceably critical maritime outlet for landlocked Ethiopia, which lost all of its ports following Eritrea's independence. Eritrea, correctly identifying Djibouti as the weakest of its neighbors and the ultimate weak spot to indirectly cripple its hated Ethiopian rival, clandestinely crossed the border into the disputed territory in 2008 and sparked the brief crisis. Horn of Africa geopolitics, especially since the end of the Cold War, are a bit tangled of a web, to put it nicely, and I don't have the time to get into it as much as I would like, but any interested listeners can read my Hybrid War series on this region at orientalreview.org if they want to learn more. About the recent threat of a return to hostilities, this could have profound implications on the regional order. Djibouti houses American, French, Japanese, Chinese, and soon even Saudi bases, while Eritrea reportedly allows the UAE to use its facilities for the war on Yemen. I doubt that a possible continuation war would drag on for long, but it would have 2 immediate consequences. The first is that it would raise shipping costs because the 2 Red Sea and Bab el-Mandab countries are fighting, and the second is that it might spook Ethiopian investors who know that almost all of their trade depends on transit through Djibouti. Both of these are directly relevant to China because of its reliance on these 2 waterways per the maritime portion of its One Belt, One Road global vision of new Silk Road connectivity with Europe, and also because Beijing recently built the Djibouti Addis Ababa Railroad to facilitate trade to its top African ally. Bearing in mind that China is opening up a base in Djibouti too, and also has very cordial relations with Eritrea in spite of the UNSC sanctions, it's possible the Chinese peacekeepers might eventually replace the recently departed Qatari ones and give a powerful boost to Beijing's strategic standing in this globally crucial region. The next one up is the UN proposal for Yemen's chief port of Hodeidah. According to Reuters, the plan calls for a supposedly neutral third-party force to take control of the vital port through which most of Yemen's imports and aid must pass en route to the rest of the humanitarian crisis-plagued state. The UN also calls on Saudi Arabia and its allies to avoid attacking the city in order to prevent a worsening catastrophe. The second component of the proposed deal is more technical and urges for the government to resume salary payments to state employees. So far, only the exiled Hadi government has agreed to the terms, while the Houthi National Liberation Movement, also known as the Ansar Allah, reportedly remains skeptical. At first thought, some observers might be wondering why the Houthis wouldn't go along with this deal in order to spare Hodeidah from the ravages of the Saudi-led war, but upon further examination, their caution is actually very prudent. The first thing to bear in mind is that the plan does not call for the Saudis to stop their war, just to take it elsewhere and away from Hodeidah. The Houthis want an end to this neo-imperialist conflict, so it's sensible why they won't settle for less at this time. The second point is that there's no telling who this supposedly neutral third-party occupying force will be, and the Houthis might rightly suspect that it'll be a country or organization which is partial to the Saudis or could easily be influenced by them. From their perspective, it doesn't necessarily make sense to hand over the lifeline to the liberated regions of northern Yemen to an unknown and therefore untrustworthy force. all while allowing the Saudis to mercilessly bomb them away from the outskirts of the city that they were forced to retreat to per the deal's condition. Furthermore, given that there's no telling who will occupy the port as part of this proposed deal, and accepting that the Saudis are in a much more powerful position to influence whoever it'll ultimately be than the Houthis could, there are legitimate reasons that the group might fear that Riyadh and its allies could end up breaking the agreement later on and using the port as the beachhead for launching a game-changing two-pronged north-south land-sea offensive against them in a final attempt to decisively end the war. Without any credible enforcement mechanism and deterrent, there is nothing other than the Saudis' word preventing this scenario from unfolding, which is why they're so suspicious of it. Having said that, however, the on-the-ground humanitarian and military conditions might become such that the Houthis could ultimately be compelled to concede to the deal as the lesser of two evils. Though, for now at least, that doesn't appear to presently be the case, and the group isn't desperate to agree to the UN proposal. Therefore, what we can read from the Houthis' skepticism so far is that they're in a comparatively comfortable position in Hodeidah and don't yet see the pressing need to unilaterally withdraw in exchange for nothing of real significance at all. Third on our countdown is Iran's anti-terrorist ballistic missile strike in eastern Syria. A lot has been said about this event so far, and I don't want to be redundant repeating what you folks might have already heard by now, so let me approach this from some fresh angles. Many analysts have talked about how this is an asymmetrical response to the Tehran terrorist attack from earlier this month, as well as an unmistakable signal to the US, Israel, and Saudi Arabia. All that is true, but I want to talk a little bit more about this in my own way. The first point of significance in this event is that the Iraqi government allowed Iran to use their airspace for this missile launch. It's known that Iraq is officially involved in quadrilateral anti-terrorist cooperation between itself, Syria, Iran, and Russia. But it's still important that this went ahead without any problems like it did. After all, Prime Minister Abadi has had a few pro-Saudi oscillations over the past year, such as dispatching the Iraqi president to the Riyadh summit last month. So it was nonetheless reassuring to know that he's still making an effort at balancing by giving Iran permission to use his country's airspace. Now about the missile strike itself, it was of course important for sending a message to the terrorists, but it gained the most value in the sense of being the first battlefield ballistic missile test that Iran has conducted in decades. Every conflict participant is testing their weapons in Syria, be it Russia or the US, so as cynical as it sounds, it's about time that Iran does so as well. This, in turn, signals to the US, Israel, and Saudi Arabia that its leadership has the political will to carry this out even amidst the heavy pressure that the trilateral coalition is putting on it nowadays. And it also indicates that Iran could easily repeat these sorts of battlefield tests under the right pretext, whether in responding against terrorists directly threatening the Islamic Republic or to extend extra tactical aid to its Syrian ally in its own war on terror. Moreover, analyzing the overall context in which the strike occurred, it can't be separated from the closing stages of the race for Raqqa and the opening ones of the dash for Deir ez-Zor. Iran's entrance into what amounts to the last main battles in the war on Daesh reveals that the country is keen on showing the world that it shouldn't be forgotten about at the final conflict resolution table, and that Iran's say, which is essentially to support Damascus with all that it does, is a paramount factor which must be included into all other players' calculations. The reason why this is so relevant nowadays is because the overall peace talk dynamics have pretty much inadvertently sidelined Iran for all intents and purposes, despite it being a formal participant in this process. So Iran's missile test is as much of a reminder to its American and Saudi rivals of its significance as it is to its Russian and Turkish partners for vastly different reasons. Our runner-up is Saudi King Salman shaking up his country's royal line of succession. The news came in during the middle of this week that the king replaced the former crown prince Mohammed bin Nayef with his son and current defense minister, Mohammed bin Salman. Mohammed bin Nayef was also dismissed from his position as interior minister during this time, too, likely in order to diminish the chance that he'd be able to marshal a group of loyalists, whether military, terrorists, and or royals, in waging a counter-coup against King Salman. Many analysts predicted that Mohammed bin Salman would eventually reach his position one way or another, but it's uncertain at this time whether or not he commands enough support from the royal family to maintain his new position and eventually succeed the king. The Saudi ruler is thought by many to have Alzheimer's disease or something similar, and to pretty much only be a figurehead for stronger powers behind him, notably his son Mohammed bin Salman. which is why we can describe the latest events as a coup by what some have called the Warrior Prince. We can speculate all day and night about whether a counter-coup is in the cards or not, but I think it's more relevant to talk a little bit more about the leadership vision than Mohammed bin Salman could bring to the kingdom, and just how fundamentally important of a change this could be for the overall direction of Saudi Arabia. I'm no fan of the defense minister, and I think it's utterly reprehensible what he's doing in Yemen and elsewhere, so nobody should mistake any of my analysis as being supportive of him on a personal or international level. When it comes to domestic politics, even his sharpest critics, myself included, can't deny that he's a relative, key word, reformist in the structural sense. Sure, he's no women's rights champion, though that's all but impossible to hope for from the royal family anyhow. Instead, what I'm talking about is his signature, Vision 2030, socioeconomic policy, which aims to reduce the kingdom's dependency on energy exports and gradually transform it into a real sector economy. To this end, he hopes to increase women's participation in the workforce and draw tangible investments into the country, such as the $65 billion that his father, King Salman, clinched during his landmark trip to China a few months ago, which essentially made the kingdom a high-level partner in Beijing's One Belt, One Road global vision of New Silk Road connectivity. In order for these reformist plans to succeed, however, the warrior prince must moderate his military and foreign policies in order to not bankrupt the kingdom and trigger destructive terrorist blowback against its domestic interests. Moreover, he also needs to avoid being as easily misled and swayed by others as he has been due to his young age and overly confident ambitions. Therefore, not only must he hold on to power long enough to become king, but he must first and foremost transform himself before he stands any realistic chance at transforming his country. At our top spot, we got the German development minister fear-mongering that up to 100 million African refugees could swarm Europe if climate and economic conditions in their homelands aren't urgently dealt with. Mr. Gerhard Müller was speaking to a German tabloid and apparently trying to sell his idea of a so-called Marshall Plan for Africa, which has previously been reported to include millions of dollars in developmental loans, grants, and other investments. According to other sources, Germany is keen to present this idea at next month's G20 summit. But judging by the fear-mongering that its authorities are engaged in, it looks like Berlin's already figured out the obvious, that it'll be a hard sell to other EU countries to agree to amidst the economic crisis. Therefore, Germany wants to scare them into going along with it and is seeking to exploit rising populist sentiment against the illegal migration of civilizationally dissimilar individuals in order to do so. Given how subservient many of the EU governments are to Germany, except of course the Polish, Hungarian, and Czech ones, which are facing unprecedented sanctions by Brussels for not agreeing to forced migrant resettlement quotas, it might already be the case that Berlin has already been promised most or all the support that it needs, and that all of this is just a PR stunt for selling the scheme to different domestic audiences. One usually overlooked observation which is relevant to focus on here is that the so-called Marshall Plan for Africa is but the latest of Germany's foreign policy ventures in Africa, which have included peacekeepers in several African countries, including the hotspots of Mali and Somalia. Moreover, Germany has silently taken the lead in building what people are calling an EU army, and a prototype coordination center of sorts called the Joint Military Headquarters was set up earlier this year to organize the bloc's activity in Africa, which the German defense minister called long overdue. It's curious that Germany is trying to be at the forefront of the EU's economic and military engagement with Africa, because this clashes with France's traditional role, with the difference being that Berlin wants its moves to be multilateral, while Paris has always opted for unilateral action. As a perfect case in point, Germany and Italy jointly proposed that an EU military force on the Libyan-Nigerian border be deployed in order to stem overwhelming migrant flows like the 100 million that Mr. Müller ridiculously fear-mongered about. But the fact is that France's existing troop deployment in Niger could already do this all on its own if there was enough political will to do so, although there's not. In terms of the larger dynamics, the bigger trend here is that Germany, and by related extent, the EU as a multilateral whole, is increasing its footprint in Africa, thereby introducing yet another great power with the political and economic will to shape regional events to various extents, which ultimately complements the Western unipolar coalition that's taking shape here between the US, France, India, and Japan to counter China. So to recap, none of this is really about 100 million African refugees, but about the hundreds of billions of dollars worth of future trade routes, minerals, and markets that all sides are competing for in the new Cold War. So all right, folks, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown, and as I always do, I want to warmly thank each and every one of you for listening to my program. Hope you tune in again next week. Have a nice weekend, and bye.